Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This hour, will young voters fulfill their political promise at long last? There are as many millennial voters in America, 69.2 million, as there are baby boomer voters. They could have some powerful electoral clout. But I think you know the rest of the story. Young voters, 18 to 35, don't turn out in the numbers that older voters do. Today, a discussion about why not, what the Obama election may have signaled to those younger voters, and whether the candidates actually care about young voters' issues. Two guests, your view today, if you're somewhere between 18 and 35, I want an honest answer here. Is there a good reason why you feel ambivalent about voting this time? Do you feel like you don't need to vote to make some kind of important change in other ways? So I'd like your candid answer. I know a lot of you are going to call up and say everybody should vote. But if you're ambivalent about it this time, you're between 18 and 35, maybe you voted in the past, maybe you've never voted, talk to me about why you feel ambivalent about it. And do you also have this sense that you can make important changes in a lot of different ways, not just in voting and actually not voting? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Tweeted out a question on it. You can find it at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest today, Ange Marie Hancock, is an associate professor of political science at the University of Southern California, where she's also associate director of the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. And she's with us today from L.A. And Ange Marie, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
David Kahn is with us. He's a journalist and columnist, along with his brother, for the Huffington Post. He's attending the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, and he's with us today from New York. And David, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, you might want to move up towards the mic a little bit there. And you can hear from the introduction that, you know, I don't want to turn this into a bad millennials for not voting show. I really do want to understand why millennial age voting underperforms. And I thought you might have some insight on that, since you're, what, 20 years old?
Yeah, I think, you know, historically, we've always seen young voters kind of turning out to a lesser extent than other generations. I think one of the reasons for that is that young voters simply aren't used to voting. They don't have a history of voting. And as people vote more and more often, voting becomes almost sticky, and you continue to vote over time. And I think this election will be interesting because it's a unique case where voter turnout could be very variable. Millennials are very disappointed in the candidates they have in front of them. They didn't vote for Hillary Clinton in the primary. They didn't vote for Donald Trump in the primary. And I think there's a big fear, especially in this election, that voter turnout will be low among millennials.
Ange Marie, I do want to say also that millennial voters are not the only, voting blocks that underperform. Latino voters have more political clout than they actually exercise through voting. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's true. I think there's been a way of thinking about Latino voters that's very much that there's a sleeping giant that's kind of going to one day awake, right? There's that kind of narrative about Latino voters. And that's very true of the way in which we think about millennials, that, you know, they somehow haven't reached their potential. But I think when you start to get into some of the subgroups among millennials, as well as the subgroups among Latinos, you start to see that certain groups are actually overperforming what we would expect. And so one of the things that you want to talk about when we're talking about millennial turnout is which pockets of millennials are turned off and which pockets of millennials are turned on.
Okay.
So look at the Dreamers.
For example. I was just going to say, this is really interesting. I've never heard this before. Which groups are overperforming then, Ange Marie? And then we'll get to the underperformers.
Oh, sure. So there are scholars who've written about black millennials who have overperformed, and they've overperformed in multiple elections. So 2004, 2008, 2012. And so you might have expected it in 08 and 12 because of Obama being on the ticket, but there's really not a very good, you know, kind of standard explanation for why black millennials were overperforming, you know, in 2004. So I think that that's one, you know, kind of group. And then also, to your point earlier about, you know, there might be other ways that people are active. Latino millennials, particularly undocumented, but even those who are citizens who are, you know, acting in solidarity because they come from mixed status families, are very much, you know, working and acting active in other parts of the political arena. So they're lobbying or they're, you know, protesting and they're organizing. And so I think, you know, you want to look at voting, and we should be very concerned about, you know, turnout in the upcoming election. But there are multiple ways that sub-pockets of millennials are extremely active in politics.
You know, now I'm going to use some of what you've just said, Anjmarie, to also reach out to our listeners. If you are one of those overperforming voter millennials, I'd like to hear about what motivates you. And then I'm also asking for you, among you who are underperformers, who sit out the elections where you could be voting. What's the thinking there? Why do you feel ambivalent? Do you feel like the vote doesn't count? Does it have something to do with what happened in 2008, all the expression of confidence in President Obama, and then the realization that kind of Washington is Washington? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Call back if you get a busy signal. I see a lot of the phone lines are busy here, to Kirsten in St. Paul. Hey, Kirsten, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, tell me how you're thinking about this.
I am personally a very fervent voter, and I vote for just about anything that comes up, but I am married to a 29-year-old man who is completely ambivalent, and it's just that very kind of cliche, jaded situation. We don't really feel like there's anybody that we genuinely trust. We were both pretty strong Bernie supporters, mm-hmm. and first campaign I've ever given money to, and I know I'm far from the only person who feels that way, but my husband and I have to twist his arm to go vote every time. And when it comes, we're Democrats, we'll support Hillary when it comes down to it. But we feel genuinely that there is just not a trusted situation to vote. So it feels like voting does not make a difference.
So when you say a trusted situation, you mean in the end, we're not sure that our vote really matters, or what?
Yes, that your vote doesn't matter because lobbyists are always going to be out there spending their money to convince people to vote a certain way, no matter what the populace says, that the candidates themselves are not particularly trustworthy. And when it did come down to the Bernie Sanders situation, a lot of young adults like us felt very strongly that finally here's somebody that we actually trust. And it felt like it had so much momentum, but when that crashed and burned, it is a very jading feeling.
Yeah, David, what do you hear in what Kirsten is saying, and do you hear this from a lot of your peers?
This is exactly what I hear from a lot of my peers. Millennials voted for Bernie Sanders. They gave him 70% of the vote in a lot of states. I mean, it wasn't even close. And the perception is that, you know, Hillary's a liar and Donald's a racist, so why should I vote for either of these guys? I think there's a very jaded feeling among this generation.
What's the answer that you give, David, to the question that you just asked, that you hear from your peers?
I mean, I don't have a great answer, to be honest.
I'd say,
hey, you should go vote. We all say that, right? But I don't think there is a great answer in this election. You know, if my political opinion, right, don't vote. We have to do whatever we can to make sure Donald Trump isn't the president. But there's no response when, lobbyists do have a huge influence in Washington. Money is dominating politics today. I think millennials have valid reasons to feel very cynical about the political process, especially in the face of four straight elections starting in 2000 when they've been disappointed in the outcome.
Let me take a call that I think actually reflects what you're saying, David, to Jack in St. Paul. Jack, is that how you feel?
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Carrie. I'm just driving around and listening to you guys. Love listening to you. But really, one of the things that I guess I hear more and more is that, and read a lot, is that millennials are trying to make a really positive change in the workplace, in their communities. And when they see politicians, especially national, really, really high profile politicians, kind of trying to continue this status quo, it's really discouraging. And, like David was saying, Bernie Sanders kind of represented something that was a lot different, and I think a lot of millennials reflected on and really felt that that was something that they would really enjoy. And when it didn't happen, people were disappointed. So I myself personally am not, as a Bernie supporter, I'm not looking at Hillary or Donald, but maybe more towards Gary Johnson, some of the Green Party, some of their public appearances haven't been really fantastic, so I'm leaning against that. But, it's just something that as a group and a generation, millennials really wanted to make a difference, and they weren't I guess, listen to during this election cycle.
Yeah, so Jack,
hopefully, you know.
Good to have your call. And you've actually brought up something that I wanted to ask Anjumarie about, which is, and I think Jack reinforces this, Anjumarie, that we see that millennial voters have a similar amount of political interest as Gen Xers and slightly older generations do. And I'm looking at a UCLA study from 2015 of college freshmen that say that their political and civil engagement was the highest it had been in 50 years. So, but then when you overlay what Jack and David have said, this kind of makes sense. Interest, but not confidence that the system can really be changed.
Yeah, and that really has, I mean, I want to agree with David, that really has shifted over just the past 15 years. So if you look at the earlier studies of millennials, 2000, 2004, they're, you know, kind of national studies of civic engagement of millennials, or youth as they were called, is very much the idea that they had a faith in government that actually paralleled the greatest generation. You know, you hadn't seen it among the baby boomers or the Gen Xers, but these past 15 years have really been a very, you know, kind of disconcerting experience for lots of millennials. So I think that that is true, that that the trust has been shaken. But let me give two possible explanations for why, and to answer David, I totally relate when people are asking me, you know, even as a Gen Xer, why should I turn out to vote? Mm-hmm. And the reason I would give for this particular election is down ballot races. I think most of us, you know, because again, there's the 4-year kind of horse race, everyone wants to focus on who's at the top of the ticket and who's at the top of the ballot. But 80 to 90% of our lives is actually affected by the folks who represent us at the state level.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, and not even just the Senate, you know, or the House of Representatives, but who's going to be governor, who's going to be in the state legislature. You know, if you care about some of the issues that have come up, whether it's something like legalization of marijuana or whether it's something like Black Lives Matter, most of those kinds of critical impacts happen at the state level. So if you really want changes in, you know, like your day-to-day life, turning up to vote, you know, regardless of who you vote for at the top of the ticket, it really matters in terms of those state level initiatives and those state level folks in office.
Yeah, Anjumarie, here's on Twitter, Hungry Traveler, who says, black female, 32, always voted, worked in politics for 10 years, annoyed with presidential primaries and local races are important. But David, what we know is that in the midterm elections, when we're reelecting state legislatures, when we've got off-year gubernatorial races, I mean, we see even millennial voting drop off even from where it is during presidential elections. That does not seem to be a compelling enough argument.
Yeah, I mean, I want to push back there, right? I was going to chime in and push back. I think, look, that's really easy to say in a civics classroom and on the radio to people who are interested and want to vote. You know, your person who tweeted, she votes, I vote, you vote. That's really hard to say to people who don't necessarily think voting is a top priority and are very, very angry at the outcome of this election and looking at this race, seeing two candidates who are the least popular candidates in American history, who don't represent us, who don't represent our values. And when the top of the ticket is so ugly and the debate is so kind of so different from what we want to be hearing, I think it's very hard to say, oh, but your local city council matters. There's this intellectual versus emotional argument.
Anjumarie, what would you say to that?
Well, I think the challenge is, of course, you know, everybody wants to focus on the national. And then to some degree, that's, you know, the parental generation, your parents, you know, who kind of have given that kind of orientation that it's really only the national that matters. And so I think if you look at virtually everything that millennials care about in terms of their top issues, the major changes that have happened have been at the state level. So when, you know, district attorneys or state's attorneys or attorney generals get turned out because people are concerned about police violence, when there are changes in terms of who has access to, you know, Cal grants in California, for example, versus, you know, who has to take out a bunch of student loans to be able to pay for college, all of those kinds of things, the major changes that have happened in the past 15 years have been at the state level about the issues that millennials in particular care about. And I get that that's a very intellectual argument that people wouldn't necessarily like automatically go there. But if you can actually show them those are your top three issues. Your top three issues are more under the control of the state than they are of any person in the White House, because I think that's part of what we were expecting in 2008, right? Like every generation thought, oh my gosh, we've elected Obama and we've got, you know, majorities in both houses of Congress. Now everything is going to be awesome, right? Like the Lego movie. And unfortunately, you know, that's just not the way that most of the issues we care about work. And that's a very disappointing kind of, you know, thing to kind of come up against, is to think everything's going to be awesome and then it's not, right?
David, I sense you know that, but I also hear what Ange Marie is saying. You know, change does not come, it's not like an epiphany kind of change just because you vote in one election.
Look, I think the party, look, first of all, I 100% agree, right? I'm politically involved. I think I understand the issues. I think it's super important to vote for these issues on a local level, especially kind of college debt and those issues that millennials care about. That's all happening at the state level. So I agree with you. My point, though, is that the political parties need to do a better job to engage millennials. And I don't blame millennials when millennials say, screw this, I'm out. I blame the political parties who nominate people like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, who cannot not, who have no ability to organize national campaigns around the issues we care about, who continue to fight over gay marriage instead of getting me a job, who continue to talk about putting up a wall on the border or pandering to millennials on the Clinton side instead of talking about how do we actually create a pathway to citizenship? Where is that pathway to citizenship? I think as millennials continue to be disappointed by the national political dialogue, they're turning off for a reason.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about the political potential that young voters have. I know you heard this 4 years ago and you heard it 4 years before that and 4 years before that. But it's interesting because this is a very engaged generation of American citizens, and yet that does not fulfill its political potential. As we started off the show, millennials aren't the only ones that don't fulfill their political potential. But we're digging in on why there's a lot of ambivalence, why this is a civic engaged generation that just doesn't exercise that potential through voting. And so if you're somewhere between 18 and 35, I'm asking for some real candor here, and I'm getting it. Is there a good reason why you feel pretty ambivalent about not just voting this time, but voting in general? Do you feel like you don't need to vote to make the important changes that you want to see made? Ange Marie Hancock is with us. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Southern California. And David Kahn is with us. He's a columnist along with his brother for the Huffington Post and in school at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Here's the number when we have open phone lines, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. Ned says it's really frustrating to see how the DNC and Hillary surrogates ignore or outright shun millennials and their concerns. Green Baby Travels Minnesota says the problem is that we want big, fast changes and have no patience for small progressive steps. And to the phones here to Joseph in Sioux Falls. Hey, Joseph. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What do you want to say?
The point I would like to make, I was actually a Bernie delegate in the state of South Dakota for the state delegation.
Yeah, good for you.
And I think that this, you know, every election you always hear, this is the most important election in our lifetime. But I truly believe that this election is. And I think that the millennials that did, you know, come out in droves to support Bernie Sanders and they're now feeling, negative about the current situation with the two nominees, need to look beyond the next 4 years and need to focus on the next 30 years. Progress is never made quickly, and I think that point was made. But with not only Justice Scalia's seat open, but right, likely Ruth Bader Ginsburg, potentially Justice Breyer, potentially Justice Kennedy, what happens this election is going to affect me as a 28-year-old till I'm probably in my 60s. And that's something that I think millennials are forgetting or just don't realize the impact and the importance of not only Supreme Court nominations, but other federal court nominations and the other appointments just made throughout the executive branch. You know, it's not just Hillary Clinton getting into the White House, or Donald Trump. It is you know, the thousands of appointees that they bring with them that affect every aspect of the federal government and every aspect of even the state and local level.
Joseph, I just wanted to ask you, when you say you were a delegate, was that to the national convention or within your state of South Dakota?
That was within my state of South Dakota.
Good. And that's really good experience. So what did you take away from that experience?
Honestly, the experience was mostly positive, but I think by the time that we had our state convention, it was pretty clear that Bernie Sanders was not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And there actually, you know, was a lot of negativity from the other Bernie Sanders supporters that I tried to rein in as best as possible and focus on, you know, try and show, you know,
okay,
America, we have a plurality voting system. It's going to be, you know, if your ideal candidate is not elected, it's going to be the lesser of two evils vote every election unless your preferred candidate is on top of the ballot.
Yeah. Now, let me put
Dulliver's Law, you know.
Yeah. Joseph,
makes it a two-party system.
I want to put that to David because, I mean, David, earlier we were talking about people that said, well, you know, we came out for Bernie, didn't happen. It's the big machine. Forget about it. You know, Joseph makes a pretty compelling argument on the other side of that, doesn't he? He stayed involved.
Yeah, I mean, staying involved is important. I think this election, he's right. This election is one of the most important elections in our lifetimes, and it's important to be involved, and it's important to engage in the issues. I guess all I'm saying, and I think this is important, is that this is a very disappointing election, and we can't blame millennials for being disappointed, and we also can't blame them for being apathetic. And I think there are different ways of engaging the political system outside of the national election. And I think that's what you're seeing a lot of millennials today trying to do. They're getting involved in the issues. They're becoming issue advocates around specific issues that are important to them. And I think we're going to see this more and more over the next couple decades, that the form of political advocacy changes. Millennials are not partisan animals. They're not partisan in the sense that they don't believe in Democratic ideology or Republican ideology. Instead, you're going to see a lot more issue advocacy moving forward.
Eric says on Twitter, have these non-voters ever heard of the Supreme Court? And Brita says, 28, recently relocated from the Iron Range to Duluth, was often the only young person participating in commercial functions. Local votes are important. Ange Marie, I want to come to you on what David just said about organizing around issues and not so much around parties. What's your political science research show you about that?
Well, I think that is true, you know, and I think that part of that has to do with, you know, one of the things that happened between Generation X and millennials was that the way that people actually got educated in high school changed. So the whole idea of a public service requirement that's common in many, many high school curricula was not there when Gen X was in high school, but is there for millennials. So I think that has started to kind of like expose millennials in a way that it didn't expose other generations to the idea that maybe it's more important, you know, is getting the work done than it is whether I'm a Democrat or a Republican. And I think there is also what David said earlier, a deep dissatisfaction with each of the parties in terms of the way in which they are engaging younger voters. I think the challenge for millennials, so I would actually put it forth as a challenge to millennial voters, is to figure out, what are you going to do for the rest of your life? So in other words, the idea is not that you have to choose between issue advocacy versus being part of a party, but part of forcing a party to take on your issues,
right,
and to represent you better,
right,
is to roll up your sleeves and to move up in the party. So to John's point, you know, of staying involved after, you know, his candidate didn't win, that's really going to like force that party to start representing those issues. And it won't be in this election necessarily. And it may not even be in 2020, but it's as those millennials continue to gain sway in that party and they become a force to be reckoned with. And this has been true of virtually every group that has been able to be incorporated into a party, right? I mean, it's part of the reason why we have a Donald Trump as a candidate, because there's a sector of the Republican Party that is driving what's going on, you know, because they've gotten involved and stayed involved and not let, you know, the party already leave them behind.
David, this is how I was thinking of this when I was imagining this conversation. It's this chicken and the egg thing that Ange Marie brings up. So if you're not involved, the candidates and the parties don't have to pay attention to you. If they will have to pay attention to you if you're involved to drive, you know, I mean, look at the Bernie Sanders thing with the college plan. He forced Hillary Clinton to come out with a wider and more thought out plan for a free college. I mean, is that a compelling argument, do you think?
I don't think millennials want to rise through the political parties. I don't think they want to kind of climb the ladder, as you were saying before. I think instead they're going to blow up the political parties. They're going to completely destroy them. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. The Democratic Party, I mean, a socialist who's never been a Democrat was almost elected the Democratic nominee, and a former Democrat was just elected the Republican nominee. We're completely destroying political silos.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think the political parties will exist in the way that we've seen them for the past 20 to 40 years. I think a lot of people think about the political parties in a very traditional sense. That's just not going to be the case in the future.
What do you think, Ange Marie?
I think that's true. I think that that is very much the case, that people want to kind of force the two-party system into a certain way. Traditionally, it's been, you know, can we form an outside third party, right? So whether it's the Libertarians or whether it's the Green Party or even, you know, in previous centuries, different parties, I think that has always been the orientation. I think the challenge is once those parties get blown up, what do you have left to really build, particularly at the presidential level where you have to build, you know, a 50-state kind of solution? How do you actually do that in a meaningful way? And so I think, you know, the one thing I do not ever underestimate is millennials' ingenuity. So I do think that there will be a tremendous amount of effort towards really rethinking what those two parties should look like.
Chris called in Minneapolis to say he's 35. The first election he got to vote in was the 2000 election when he was 18. In that election, the popular vote didn't turn out to be the president. It was disheartening. That was the Bush v. Gore case. It was disheartening for him. Feels like the vote doesn't actually matter that much. Vincent says he's 25. He came of age after 9/11, went to college during the recession, is buried in debt, feels like no politicians are listening to what's going on, doesn't feel like the problems of his generation even register with politicians. David, it sounds like you've heard sentiment like that from a lot of your contemporaries.
This is exactly the sentiment I'm talking about. This is the generation that survived 9/11, that survived the Great Recession, and that's still feeling the damage of the Great Recession right now in terms of this wage scar that's going to last, that's already lasted kind of 10 years after the recession and continues to last years after that. And I think this kind of rosy picture of America that I think a lot of liberals like to paint right now, that we see Obama saying, look, I've had a super successful term, I think there's a lot of pushback against that among people who are feeling the pain.
Christina says, I'm voting green because we need to plan for the future. We need to help the Greens receive major party status. And by the way, I'm hearing from a lot of listeners on Twitter about third parties. Here's Ryan, who says, I feel the government should be allocated based of size of population. There need to be more millennials in government. David, I note that you are the author of When Millennials Rule, The Reshaping of America. So when will that be?
I think that's already happening. You know, I think you're seeing young elected officials running for office. But B, like I said before, I think millennials are just taking over the political parties. We're hijacking the political process for our own means. And I think that's what you saw with Democrats, and that's what you're going to see with the Republicans. And so I see a more radical transformation happening right now as we speak, where millennials are taking over the political parties, they're taking over the political process, and they're going to use these parties to achieve their goals. And I think when you look at what millennials actually want, there's a lot more consensus among millennials than there is among any other generation.
To the phones, to Luke in Minneapolis. Hey, Luke. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. What are you thinking about?
So I think I have a few quick comments, and then you guys can take them wherever you want to go with them. But I think, first of all, it's kind of difficult to lump an entire group of people together from the ages of 18 to 35.
True.
I think that's a very large age difference. And as a 24-year-old, in a lot of ways, I think I feel more connection to someone who's in their early 30s than their late teens.
Mm-hmm.
But regarding this election specifically, I think part of the problem is that a lot of younger people think I mean, to use the cliche, they think a lot more with their heart than with their head. So a candidate like Bernie Sanders can get young people very riled up and very active in the process early on. But if that candidate isn't able to actually win the primary, which it turned out he wasn't, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Hillary Clinton won fair and square in the Democratic primary, then the younger people kind of lose their initial gusto and kind of fizzle out.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I don't know if it's related to the idea of millennials feeling more entitled. And so if their kind of preference doesn't win out, then they're just going to say, forget about it. But
yeah, Luke, you're bringing up something that I wanted to ask Anja Marie about, and this goes back to 2008, Anja Marie. I think I alluded to this earlier in the conversation. You know, big turnout, I think, what, 50% of millennials turned out in the presidential election of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
High expectations. President Obama ran into a lot of the same old Washington paralysis. He even had a hard time activating those groups of young voters in 2012 at the same level.
Right.
How do you think that affects the way some of these voters who were in, you know, 18 to maybe 22 or 24 at that point now see the electoral process today?
I think it did affect tremendously those voters who were either casting their vote, you know, for the first or the second time. So I know we were talking to older millennials a few minutes ago, but for those younger millennials, you know, who's got to cast their first vote for, you know, the first black president in 2008, you know, so they were 18 in 2008, or they were 22 in 2008 and were just casting their second vote. I think that idea and that faith that was placed in, you know, Barack Obama was absolutely something that, and now he will fix everything, right? Because even though he is technically a baby boomer, everybody kind of saw him as this young, this fresh,
right,
this new voice. And that was across generations, right? That we need this fundamental change. That was the theme of his, you know, 2008 election. And I think what happened among, and I think it had a significant impact, more significant impact on millennials than on other generations. But what happened was everybody kind of said, you know, it was almost like we were electing Barack Obama Jesus Christ and not President of the United States. You know, we expected him to do everything from curing cancer to solving the climate crisis, you know, because of the way that he was elected and how symbolic and good we all felt, you know, about the fact that we've been able to achieve this milestone. I don't think that same kind of narrative is going on in this election, which really will is both a product of the disappointment in 2008 and 2012, but also just a reflection of, you know, how voters frankly feel about Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I think they're two very different candidates.
I mean, here's the other thing to note, Anja Marie, even with the mandate that President Obama had, he ran into the same barriers and the same Washington paralysis. I don't blame people for being disillusioned. It was, I mean, not that he did do a lot of what he wanted to do. It was difficult. But, you know, from the outside looking in, it looks like an agenda that was stopped in a lot of ways, even though we had this big mandate going in 2008.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think the challenge to us as, you know, as people who are active in politics, people who are engaged in politics, is that we kind of, you know, wanted and thought that that mandate would be enough.
Right.
And I think nobody was really prepared for the level of intransigence and the level of paralysis that, you know, he would encounter, some of which was definitely racialized, some of which was just, frankly, you know, good old partisan politics. And so I think nobody was prepared for that level of gridlock. And I think millennials were particularly not prepared for it because they hadn't necessarily lived through, you know, they might have been babies, but they hadn't necessarily lived through in the same way other generations had the Clinton gridlock of the 1990s.
Andrew says on Twitter, what about my generation being involved, getting represented locally, seeing a ton of us really involved lately in city and neighborhood politics? And here's the other thing. We're going to get a look at the latest news. But on the other side of news, I want to talk to David and Anja Marie and you about the mechanics of voting. I was just in Colorado over the weekend. They've gotten really progressive on getting young people to vote. They do this pre-registration before the voter even turns 18. I want to talk to David and Anjumarie about whether, and even David said, I think, earlier that it becomes habitual. It's the thing you do. So we'll talk about where the mechanics fit into this conversation. Discussion on millennials, voting, electoral and potential political clout. Love to hear your views on this. Call us back if you get a busy signal. I want to talk to you about how you're feeling, the ambivalence, good reason to vote this time, good reason to be involved politically from the top all the way down to the bottom to your neighborhood and city council. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. President Obama makes his first visit to flood-ravaged southern Louisiana today. The president had taken some criticism by opting to finish a two-week family vacation in Martha's Vineyard before inspecting the flood damage personally and meeting with residents. Flooding has damaged some 60,000 homes in Louisiana, and thousands of people are in or looking for temporary housing. The U.S. military says an American soldier has been killed and another wounded by a roadside bomb during an operation in Afghanistan. A statement says six Afghan soldiers were wounded as well. The attack came a day after 100 U.S. troops were sent to help defend the region, which appears to be at increasing risk of falling to the Taliban. Police in Chicago say three children and a man died in a fire at a Chicago apartment building. They say the fire appears to have been deliberately set after a domestic dispute. The fire began in a three-story building in the South Chicago neighborhood. Firefighters have been battling numerous wildfires in the West, including three in the Spokane, Washington area that have destroyed more than 27 homes. In California, a wildfire that's burned more than 50 square miles is mostly under control, but a blaze in coastal San Luis Obispo and Monterey counties is threatening nearly 1,900 structures, and more than 2,400 people have been under evacuation orders. And a funeral is being held today for a Missouri woman who was beaten to death outside the Illinois hospital where she was being treated for breast cancer. Police say 46-year-old Shannon Vincel was hit over the head last week as she sat outside the Cancer Treatment Centers of America facility in Zion, Illinois. She died the next day. There have been no arrests. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:43.
Sometimes the presidential campaign can sound like this.
You really think Donald Trump has the temperament to be commander-in-chief?
Hillary Clinton may be the most corrupt person ever to see.
A lot of he said, she said.
With a
secret
tweet
speeches.
Is not
at NPR, we bring you the fact checks and context behind the speeches. Listen every day.
Discover what matters in election coverage. Elect NPR News on the air and online at nprnews.org.
Kat tweeted, when you're late for an appointment because you don't want to get out of the car mid-NPR program, you never have to miss what we're talking about. If you've got things to do, your life to lead, you can find all these shows on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes, and I'll be right there for you.
Support for this program comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Voting potential and ideas here among younger voters. Anjumarie Hancock with us from the University of Southern California, where she's Associate Director of the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. And David Kahn with us, a journalist and a columnist and attending the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. David, I see you going back and forth on Twitter with our friend of the show, Abir, and she is saying to you, what I see is a systematically disadvantageous system of democracy combined with the trope of the entitled millennial. And you tweeted back at her, well said. And then you're talking about the day is coming when we'll be taking over. You said, and our response is that we're going to take over the electorate. Our generation can fix this. Why are you so sure of that?
Look, I think millennials today are one third of voters. And when you look at the actual state of kind of this recent election, millennials had a huge influence. And yeah, we didn't win this time, but we're very close. We're close enough that next time we will win. And I'm confident that in 2020 and in 2024, you're going to see millennials you know, with even more than a third of the electorate, they're going to be deciding the outcome of the primaries as well as
really?
The general election.
Wow.
And I think they're going to decide the outcome of this general election. And then when you look at 2016 election, the winner will be decided by the millennial generation.
Anja Marie, do the numbers add up the way David thinks they do?
I think that they could. The only reason I'm a little less confident than David is because of the challenge of those midterm elections and keeping millennial voters engaged and not cynical to the point of staying home. And so I think, you know, a significant drop off in 2016 would not only hurt someone like a Hillary Clinton, but it would also deeply, deeply damage the potential to do that in 2020, right? Because you ramp up many, many years before you actually get to that presidential election.
Right. To Taylor in Minneapolis. Hey, Taylor, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Yeah, no problem.
What'd you want to say?
Well, so as a person who's been through the system, I was a state Senate candidate when I was 22 years old. So
that's good.
I hear a lot of people talking about why don't millennials get involved, and I think a lot of it is we're often told, you know, the same trope, wait our turn, and so we have to sit back and watch the system that is plainly broken. Millennials want choice. That's, I mean, when you have 43% of the country identifying themselves as independent, basically saying, I am not a Democrat or a Republican, there is something wrong with a system that forces us into one of two boxes. And so for me, I think we need to be looking at alternative election systems. We need to be looking at the mechanics of how we vote. And so something like ranked choice voting, where we're actually able to empower a Green Party, a Libertarian Party, is something that's incredibly important and something we should be moving towards.
Good. This is really glad to have your call. This is something that I wanted to talk about, just the details of this. Eva tweets, 27 in Minneapolis. I think another problem is having the time to vote. Millennials work odd and multiple jobs. Voting takes more planning. David, as I mentioned, I was in Colorado. They do this. They do, I think, some really interesting things around voting, including pre-registration before the voter turns 18. They have drive-through ballot drop-offs, and they have seen higher turnout among young voters. How much of a difference might this make?
I think it makes a huge difference. I think something we're seeing a lot now in the South especially is legislatures actually passing the opposite provisions to disenfranchise young people. They're afraid of the impact that young voters will have, especially on the GOP in many southern states. And I think, again, that kind of contributes to this frustration. You're right. These programs are awesome. We need more of them. But instead of having more of them, we have less and less of them as states cancel same-day registration, as states cancel the ability to vote early, as states implement voter ID laws, which disproportionately impact African-Americans and young people. So unfortunately, we're moving in the wrong direction there.
Anja Maria, I know what the legislatures are doing on voter ID. I mean, we see the court overturning that in a state like North Carolina. Right. Is David right, though, with this overall view that legislatures want to disincentivize young voters from voting?
Yes, absolutely. And part of that has to do with, I think we had a caller say earlier, you know, you can't just lump a whole group of people together. Part of that has to do with what we call, demographers call, the cultural generation gap, that this generation is significantly more racially diverse. So part of where some of their, you know, kind of more liberal or more, you know, libertarian views come from with regard to certain political issues absolutely have to do with the fact that they're a more diverse generation. They've been exposed to more diverse and difference than baby boomers or Gen X has in the past. And so I think there is this move to disincentivize voters that state legislators think are going to vote against them in the future. So it's a naked political move, you know, even though it's couched in this language of voter fraud. I actually have a student who studied this and demonstrated that the legislators that have higher levels of racial resentment tend to be more supportive of those voter ID laws.
Wow.
Than those who are less racially resentful.
Say that again. I want to make sure that point is not missed.
Yeah. So I have a student of mine did a paper with a colleague. So my student's name is Matthew Mendez, and he did a paper with a colleague of mine that showed, using a field experiment, that state legislators who were, you know, kind of less likely to respond to people who had ethnic sounding names.
Mm-hmm.
So that was their kind of mode of racial resentment. Less likely to respond in either a positive way or to respond at all, right, to just ignore them, were more likely to support those pieces of legislation for voter ID laws. And so I think it's the combination of age and racial and ethnic diversity together that is going to impact how many millennials are going to be disenfranchised by many of these voter ID laws.
Joanna in Rochester called in to say the main reason she doesn't want to go out and vote, no matter who she votes for, neither party is willing to put aside the partisan issues and get something done. Instead, she thinks her peers need to get involved in their local communities. And then Joe says on Twitter, long view, change takes more than a vote every 4 years. Need to stay engaged. If we expect it is corrupt, it will be. What about that logic, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this long view. That's right. And I think, you know, like we were talking about earlier on the show, you know, people need to stay involved and vote in their local elections. But I think there's this element of the short view, too. Robots are taking over. Globalization is happening. Things are moving way faster. Millennials expect them to move faster. And we expect government to respond. And I think just like Silicon Valley is disrupting many industries that fail to innovate, young people are going to disrupt Washington because Washington has failed to innovate.
I sure hope so. Hope that's true. To the phones to Emily in Hopkins. Hey, Emily, what's your experience with this?
Hi there. I was an avid Bernie supporter, and when it became apparent that he was not going to make it, I struggled for a long time, and I thought, you know, I think I just won't vote. You know, because I can't get behind Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that apathy, you know, distrust of someone who is a career politician. But thinking about it now, I really struggled. And I talked with a lot of people, you know, on this program, you've been talking about millennials who do go out and vote. So African-Americans and different groups like that. And I talked with some of my friends and I realized, you know, the reason I supported Bernie and the reason I supported his ideology was because I care about what it means for everyday people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if millennials sort of take a step back and they think, okay, why do I support the things I support? You have to realize that maybe you won't get everything. But if you can just get a person in office who's going to make people's lives better, you know, so Hillary's affordable college plan, you know, it's not quite Bernie's idea, but it's something that would honestly help a lot of people. So I think maybe, you know, if you just take a step back, maybe that's something the older generation is better than a lot of us are.
Okay.
Something probably that comes with age and maturity.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's sort of what I've been thinking about.
It's good to have your thoughts on this, Emily, because I wanted to ask Ange Marie about what happens with a lot of the energy that Bernie Sanders was able to harness and motivate Ange Marie when now he's not on the ballot and Hillary Clinton hasn't picked up all of his ideas. Of course, she wouldn't. What happens to all that, do you think?
Well, I think a couple of things can happen. I was really glad to hear, you know, a millennial who had been running for office a few minutes ago. I think part of it is, you know, people want to take some of these ideas and run with them at that state and local level. So, for example, yesterday was the 20th anniversary of welfare reform in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what was passed in 1996 had been tested and, you know, kind of tried out in the states before it became national policy. And that had happened over, you know, a 10 or 15 year period. And so I think some of those kinds of solutions, the same thing with Obamacare, you know, that it had been tested in Massachusetts and in other states. I think part of what you want to see millennials do if they are, in fact, not going to run for office themselves or not doing kind of, you know, the lobbying and the organizing work is to think about how can we create states as kind of labs. So, you know, to David's point earlier about kind of blowing up government, I think one of the challenges is how can you do that? How can you do, you know, to use the language of the tech world, how can you alpha phase something? How can you beta phase something? You know, and then, you know, each test period, the alpha test, the beta test, you then, you know, have something that you could take up to the national level that you think would really work on that, you know, 50 state scale.
You know, David, I think that's a really good question because you can see, here's an example. We've done a lot of shows on criminal justice reform. You can see that happening in individual states, responses to climate change away from the paralysis of the federal government. Is that a potential argument to keep millennials involved, not just at the, you know, at the highest level?
Yeah, for sure. I think experimentation is super important. And I think we've seen that be highly successful on the state level when we experiment in healthcare and in innovation and in kind of unique policies for responding to some of these tough challenges we're facing, like college education. Tennessee has done a lot of experimentation around free college education and around how to kind of re-educate the workforce for this changing society. So state-level experimentation is definitely important. I wish we saw more candidates on the gubernatorial level actually campaigning for change.
Yeah.
Frankly, most of the time when I hear about gubernatorial candidates, it's because they're getting arrested for being corrupt. Like where I go to college in Pennsylvania.
What? Where?
Or I go to college in Pennsylvania. We just had our state attorney general step down.
Yes.
I think in New York State, for example, a state level politician is more likely to go to jail for corruption than lose their reelection campaign.
Well, I mean, David, you ought to be going to school in Minnesota, because as far as I can think, that has never happened here.
So, yeah, I wish we had kind of more change on the gubernatorial level. I think it's a great opportunity to experiment. Unfortunately, right now, with lacking great candidates to do that, that experimentation simply isn't happening. I don't see that outside of a few good examples like Tennessee for college education or Colorado for legalizing marijuana. You know, most states like New York, Pennsylvania, not really experimenting all too much.
Ryan says there need to be term limits and age caps. 70-year-old politicians don't speak for the majority of society or the future. Newsflash, Bernie is a career politician, too. And a quick comment here from Sam in Duluth. Hey, Sam, I'm a little short on time, but I did want to hear what you had to say. What are you thinking about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not a problem. My big issue with the whole political system has been just how arcane the actual voting process is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we're given this whole, you know, narrative that if you vote, things will be awesome and you will get your voice heard. But then, you know, people then poo-poo us and say, oh, your issue is not going to matter at the convention because of all these parliamentary procedure things, or, you know, oh, your candidate's not going to win because the Electoral College needs this many votes for your candidate. And I mean, it's partly, you know, how the system is set up to be, you know, deliberately inefficient, which as the founding fathers sort of intended, but then it's also, you know, the issue is like, you know, We're sort of shut down by people of older generations, you know, who want us to get involved, but they want us to get involved in their way, not in the way that actually energizes us.
Anjmarie, will you say something to that?
I think that is true. When we think about the way in which we want to make sure that people are actually engaged in the process. I know you're short on time, so I'll keep it there.
Hey, thanks very much. Really good to have you. Appreciate your time and your insight here.
It's been great to be here.
David, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and insight as well.
Thanks a lot. I had a good time.
David Kahn is the author of When Millennials Rule, The Reshaping of America. Anjmarie Hancock is the associate director of the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration.